into a nuclear war. And I think it's that American people should be horrified that this is the direction that our government is taking us. And it's the Ukrainian lives that are being lost and sacrificed every day while the U.S. is trying to weaken Russia. Enough is enough. Negotiations now.
I wanted to get Matt's response to China. Both Vice President Harris and Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned China at the Munich Security Conference this weekend against providing support to Moscow, as reports emerged Beijing supplying Russian forces with non-lethal military assistance. Beijing responded to the U.S. threats earlier today.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even coercing us.
That's Wang Wenbin, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson. Matt Duss.
I mean, well, you can't dismiss what he just said. I mean, certainly the United States has been supplying weapons. And more broadly, I think there are, you know, part of what China is able to exploit in its own rhetoric is the fact that the United States has a very bad record on these issues going back many decades. It employs a whole series of double standards on issues of international law when it comes to dealing with friends versus dealing with adversaries. And I do think these are arguments that have, have an audience in the world, particularly in the global south. Now, certainly, I think China, has its own problems, both with its foreign policy and certainly with its domestic affairs, its repression of the Uyghurs, just to name one of the various abuses it's been carrying out. But I think we should not dismiss these arguments. Now, as for China's role in brokering peace, personally, I'm very skeptical that the Chinese government will be willing to play an actually productive role here. They do have influence with Vladimir Putin, certainly. He's become much, much more reliant on support from the Chinese government over the course of this war. But going back to what Medea mentioned, Brazilian President Lula, I certainly don't dismiss the possibility that Lula could play a productive role in this as well. This is something I think the United States, frankly, should be willing to work with. If the president and his administration have at least rhetorically said that we need to make space for others to play a role, particularly leaders from the global south in global affairs. So I think we should be willing to see if Lula can produce something here and not dismiss that out of hand.
Well, we gave you the first word, Matt. So Medea Benjamin, the last word.
I think it's very exciting that the Chinese are coming up with a peace plan, because we know that Putin would be on board for that. And then we have to get the U.S. and Zelensky on board for that as well. I think there is this very loud groundswell coming up from below and from the global south to say enough. We have to find a way to end this. It's causing greater hunger around the entire world. It's causing greater increase in prices of energy. It's causing more dirty energy to be used. It's time to find a solution. And I think now it's the West against the rest of the world saying end this war now.
Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, her book War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, and Matt Duss, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll link to your new piece, A Better Biden Doctrine, at democracynow.org. Next up, the Munich Security Conference this weekend. Vice President Kamala Harris accuses Russia of committing crimes against humanity. We'll get response from war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody. Stay with us.
I am rising with the sun.
handled by Aksene Cervenka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the weekend at the Munich Security Conference, Vice President Kamala Harris accused Russia of committing not just war crimes, but crimes against humanity in Ukraine.
The United States has formally determined that Russia has committed crimes against humanity. And I say to all those who have perpetrated these crimes and to their superiors who are complicit in these crimes, you will be held to account.
Secretary of State Tony Blinken followed up on Harris's comments by saying in a statement, "We reserve crimes against humanity determinations for the most egregious crimes. These acts are not random or spontaneous. They're part of the Kremlin's widespread and systematic attack against Ukraine's civilian population," Blinken said. We go now to Geneva, Switzerland, where we're joined by the longtime human rights attorney Reid Brody, who's brought historic legal cases against former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, former Chadian dictator Hissein Habre, and others, author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. He's former counsel for Human Rights Watch. Reid, thanks so much for joining us. Can you talk—I don't know if people caught the shift right now for exactly what Vice President Harris and, I expect tomorrow, President Biden in Poland will be saying.
Well, Vice President Harris basically said what we all know to be true, which is that Russian forces are committing crimes against humanity in Ukraine. Secretary Blinken used, and in fact, they both used the legal definition, which is crimes committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack on a civilian population. I think we all believe that, you know, the bombing of hospitals and schools, the torture, the sexual violence, the attacks on civilian infrastructures, the deportation of children, these are all amount to crimes against humanity. I'm not sure, to be honest, what the you know, why the statement was made, what legal significance it has that the U.S. has determined that crimes against humanity have been committed. She also talked about how the authors of these crimes will be held to account. And of course, as we've discussed before, there is a massive justice mobilization in Ukraine, which surpassing any precedent by orders of magnitude. You have 66,000 war crimes cases opened by the Ukrainian prosecutor's office. The International Criminal Court has opened its largest field operation ever. A dozen other cases have states have jumped in to open up cases on their own soil. Many others have supplied assistance, financial, technical assistance to Ukrainian prosecutors. So there is a huge amount of investigation in real time like we have never seen before. I don't know what new this is going to bring. I mean, perhaps President Biden is going to explain. Obviously, the U.S., you know, has a very ambiguous relationship in general with international justice. It is not a member of the International Criminal Court. It does support, actually, under the Democratic administrations, including the Biden administration, support the work of the International Criminal Court. But we'll have to really see what this declaration means. I mean, it is a very strong statement, and I think in many ways it is a welcome statement. Crimes against humanity are being committed by Russian forces in Ukraine.
Reid, we just had you on 2 weeks ago talking about the issue of war as a crime of aggression and the problem that poses for the United States, because many might say, yes, that's exactly what's going on here. But for the United States to say that is to go against its previous positions.
Well, of course, I mean, the U.S. position on justice is, you know, on international justice is riddled with double standards. Look, the U.S.'s principal objection to the International Criminal Court is, you know, is not that they're investigating Africans or they're investigating these people. The U.S.'s principal objection is that the ICC purports to investigate crimes committed by citizens of non-state parties. So the U.S.'s big objection is that the ICC could and was, until it was deprioritized by the prosecutor, investigate alleged U.S. war crimes in Ukraine. U.S. is not a party, but Afghanistan. U.S. is not a party, but Afghanistan is. The ICC similarly is investigating alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity by Russian forces, even though Russia, like the United States, is not a party to the ICC, but is allegedly committing war crimes and crimes against humanity on the territory of the state Ukraine, which is a party. The same double standard comes in, or would come in terms of aggression prosecutions. Now, Vice President Harris did not talk about the crime of aggression, and one interpretation of why she made such a strong statement on crimes against humanity this weekend is so that she didn't have to talk about the crime of aggression, because the U.S. is tiptoeing around this issue for the reason that you mentioned, Amy. The U.S.
I mean,
the
right
only
now
reason,
we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, right, in March of 2020, in March of 2003.
Exactly. The only reason the ICC does not, which is investigating Russia, non-party state, investigating their alleged crimes against humanity and war crimes in Ukraine, but not their aggression, is, and many would say the only reason the ICC hasn't already indicted Vladimir Putin for the crime of aggression, which was the supreme international crime at Nuremberg, is that the United States, Britain, and France insisted, against the majority of the other states, that the ICC should not be able to exercise its aggression jurisdiction against non-state parties like the United States, France, and Britain, but also like Russia. I mean, again, it's a very welcome statement by Vice President Harris. Russia, these are massive crimes. I mean, these are, you know, we are all continue to be shocked and horrified by these crimes. But America has to, the United States has to come to grips with the fact that whether it's crimes against, whether it's crimes like the Bush administration, crimes against detainees in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and secret prisons that were never dealt with, or the illegal invasion of Iraq by the United States in 2003 and 2002. You can never, you know, you can't have it both ways. And the tools of international justice should not only be aimed at enemies and outcasts.
Reid Brody, I want to thank you for being with us. War crimes prosecutor, former counsel for Human Rights Watch, author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. Next up, as the Centers for Disease Control warns teen girls face record levels of depression and hopelessness, we look at the role of social media. Back in 30 seconds. Irreversible Damage by Algiers featuring Zach De La Roca. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Centers for Disease Control's warning teen girls across the U.S. are engulfed in a, quote, growing wave of violence and trauma. as new data shows there's been an increase in rapes and sexual assaults, as well as record levels of depression and hopelessness. The data is from a 2021 CDC survey conducted on 17,000 high school teenagers, where nearly a third of teen girls said they'd seriously considered suicide, up nearly 60% from a decade ago. At least 13% of them said they'd attempted suicide in the past year, while almost 15% of the girls surveyed said they'd been sexually assaulted. We turn now to look at calls from Congress to do more to protect children, especially girls, online. We're joined by three guests who testified last week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Josh Golan is the executive director of Fair Play, which protects children from the harmful manipulations of big tech. Dr. Mitch Prinstein is the chief science officer at the American Psychological Association. He's also a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Emma Lempke joins us. She is the founder of Log Off Movement, which is to get kids offline. She's a sophomore studying political science at Washington University in St. Louis. She's joining us from her dorm room right now. But first, I want to go to a part of what you told senators last week in Congress.
As my screen time increased, my mental and physical health suffered. The constant quantification of my worth through likes, comments, and followers heightened my anxiety and deepened my depression. As a young woman, the constant exposure to unrealistic body standards and harmful recommended content led me towards disordered eating and severely damaged my sense of self.
A sophomore in college, Washington University, addressing the Senate Judiciary Committee. Emma, thanks so much for joining us today. Can you talk about exactly what happened to you, the amount of time you spent online, and how it affected you psychologically?
Absolutely. And thank you for having me on today. So I got my first social media account in the sixth grade at around the age of 12. And as I began to spend more time on these platforms, my mental and physical health suffered. The constant quantification of my worth through likes, comments, and followers heightened my anxiety and really led me towards a worsened mental state. And the constant exposure to harmful recommended content that was feeding me pro-anorexic content led me towards disordered eating. All of these negative consequences I still deal with and grapple with today.
Talk about this issue of disordered eating and how it came from what you were imbibing from online. Talk about how it works, the whole algorithm, and what you were looking at and the silos it brought you down.
Absolutely. So I always use YouTube as an example. So when I was a young girl, 12 years old, and I went on YouTube to look up a good workout or a healthy recipe, that one search indicated to the algorithm that it should feed me pro-anorexic content. So within seconds of watching that video, addictive algorithmic design techniques such as autoplay that keeps a video recommended playing and you don't have to click anything and it will send it to you, that led me towards dangerous rabbit holes, feeding me pro-anorexic content when all I wanted was a healthy recipe.
So how did you deal with this? I mean, you're talking about going on in sixth grade onto social media. How many years did it take you to say, hey, we ought to get off of this?
It took me about 3 to 4 years. You know, I got Instagram at the age of 12 in the sixth grade, and it took getting into the ninth grade, entering high school, to reach a breaking point. And that being said, the negative consequences that that really appeared through my usage of social media, I still am grappling with today. I'm still repairing my sense of self, my body image. And those things are incredibly detrimental, specifically when you're dealing with them during your most formative years. So that is kind of one of the reasons why I launched into the Log Off movement and my own advocacy, was to protect all of those 12-year-old girls and young women who are yet to interact with these online places and are yet to enter these dangerous rabbit holes.
I mean, are you a total Luddite? You obviously aren't completely off social media, because here we are talking mm-hmm. through Skype.
I'm not, and I think that that's one really integral piece of information that my generation understands. It's that social media and the online world is multifaceted. We can connect with one another, we can express ourselves, and we can explore these online spaces. But What is important is that they are regulated and that they are safe for young users, that addictive designs like autoplay does not send me, a 12-year-old girl, into a depressive pro-anorexic content hole. So I'm still on these apps, but I have placed levels of friction between me and these addictive technologies. One thing that I do not think should be on the user, a burden that should not be on the parents, but should be on these companies to not addict their young users.
So, Dr. Mitch Prinstein, chief science officer at the American Psychological Association, also professor of psychology at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, you're dealing with young people like Emma every day. What are you recommending, and what did you tell the senators last week?
Well, first of all, we have to be really careful about the age that kids are first getting on. Remember that the brain is going through one of the most important periods of development right around 10, 11, 12. In fact, the brain's not fully developed until 25. So we've got a biological vulnerability period where kids are going to want things like interaction with peers, likes, reposts. Those are the kinds of things that are triggering a part of the brain that becomes really supercharged at that pubertal transition period. We also have to be really careful about kids' addiction or dependency online. We're finding that 50% of teens are having such a hard time getting offline. They can't stop. They are spending a lot of time to make sure they have perpetual access. It's interfering with their daily roles and routines.
And suicide, such a painful increase among girls. I mean, it is absolutely astounding, these figures, that nearly a third of teen girls said they'd seriously considered suicide, up nearly 60% from a decade ago. At least 13% of them said they'd attempted suicide in the past year.
Yeah, we've seen incredibly high rates and increasing rates even before the pandemic. This is a decades-long problem with youth mental health. But what we're seeing now, and perhaps linked to social media, is a tremendous amount of discrimination and cyberbullying that's happening, sometimes with kids even telling one another that they should attempt to end their lives as a form of bullying on social media. And just like the pro-anorexia content that Emma was discussing, there's a remarkable amount of content that encourages kids to cut themselves or to think about suicide, even sanctions kids when they talk about maybe not cutting themselves anymore, with remarkably explicit content, teaching them not only how to do it, but how to conceal that information from their parents.
Emma, were you concealing information from your parents?
I don't think that it was that I was necessarily concealing the information. I think I felt really hopeless and I didn't know what to do. And I assume that my parents would not know what to do either, since they are not digital natives. So I think that's one very unique position that my generation, Gen Z, is put into as we get older, is we have this understanding of these acute harms that are present within these online spaces. And it is on us to tell our stories, to inform other generations, to protect the next generation.
Let's bring Josh Golan into this conversation. Josh Golan is the executive director of Fair Play, joining us from Newton, Massachusetts. Josh, you also testified before the Senate, and you were particularly holding big media accountable. What do you demand they do? And do you believe actually in self-regulation? I don't mean kids like Emma. I mean the companies. Can you trust them to regulate? Or what are you demanding that the U.S. government do?
Yeah, no, we absolutely cannot trust these platforms to self-regulate. Congress has not passed a law to protect children online since 1998, and that law only protects children up to until their 13th birthday, so teens have no protections on right now. So the situation that Dr. Prinstein and Emma were describing has occurred in a completely unregulated environment. The platforms, you know, when they are caught doing harmful things to young people, first they deny it, then they drag their feet, then they may make some superficial changes. It shouldn't be up to them to decide 100% how these environments, which our kids are spending 6, 8, 10 hours a day in, are designed. We need safeguards. We need new policies. Some of the things that my organization is calling for, and legislation which Congress considered last year, like the Kids Online Safety Act and the Children and Teens Online Privacy and Protection Act, some of the things this legislation would do, extend privacy protections to teens so that not as much data can be collected, which fuels all these harmful recommendations. End surveillance advertising to kids, end targeted marketing to children and teens. All of this is happening in order to hook kids, in order to sell them to advertisers. So we need to disrupt the business model. And last but not least is we need a duty of care. We need platforms to have a legal obligation to consider how their platforms are designed and how their algorithms are designed, and to prevent and mitigate the most serious harms to young people. Right now, their only responsibility is to their shareholders, and as long as their only responsibility is to their shareholders, they're going to keep trying to addict kids any way they can, even if it means serving them pro-anorexic content, pro-self-harm content.
I want to go to an Axios event in Philadelphia about a half a decade ago. 2018, Facebook's founding president, Sean Parker, saying the site's deliberately designed to hook users.
That thought process was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you, you know, more likes and comments. I mean, it's a social validation feedback loop that it's like a, I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. It literally changes your relationship with society, with each other, with, you know, it probably interferes with productivity in weird ways. It, God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains.
So that's Sean Parker, founding president of Facebook. Dr. Mitch Prinstein, how do you force this regulation, and who are the forces that are fighting you, for example, in Congress?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a variety of ways that this could be regulated from a legal perspective. But if you listen to that piece, these are brilliant folks who have created a terrific platform for keeping kids engaged. Imagine what you can do with that if it was being used for good, if it was being used to teach kindness or to help kids with their emotion regulation skills or their psychological development. I think that at the very least, we should use this amazing profit that social media companies have amassed to teach kids how to use their platforms in really beneficial ways to get the most psychological good to come out of it, and maybe even to create modules or experiences that we know could train kids and prevent them from mental health difficulties.
And Emma, you talk about logging off. You founded the Log Off movement, but you're not completely logging off. So what do you say to young people? How can you do it in any kind of healthy way?
What I say to young people is you need to mentally log off and reflect back on your own usage, asking deeper questions. Why am I on these platforms? Who do I follow? What makes me happy? Where am I harmed? And in answering these questions, young people can begin to curate their experiences online for themselves, prioritizing their safety, their well-being, over other companies prioritizing the maximization of our attention. It is all about placing levels of friction between us and these addictive technologies. And that has to be facilitated through self-reflection.
Emma Lemke, we want to thank you for being with us, founder of Log Off Movement, Josh Golan, executive director of Fair Play, and Dr. Mitch Prinstein, chief science officer at the American Psychological Association, professor of psychology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, you can call 988. That's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. That's right, dial 988. Or you can go to the crisis text line by texting HOME to 741-741.
At CJSF, we would like to take this opportunity to learn about the importance and significance of Black History Month in Canada. Black Canadians and the communities have been a part of shaping Canada's heritage and identity since the early 1600s, yet their role has been disregarded for many years. This changed in December 1995 when the House of Commons officially recognized February as Black History Month in Canada. Years later, in February 2008, Donald Oliver, the first Black man appointed to the Senate, introduced the motion to recognize the contributions of Black Canadians in February as Black History Month.
This is Radio Goethe on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.